loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Bernie Sanders has officially thrown his hat into the ring for the 2020 presidential race. Next, President Trump publicly called for the Venezuelan military to support Juan Guaido in a campaign-style speech in Miami. Then, in the now, a news video service by RTE has been taken off Facebook without warning. And then several members of parliament in Britain have left the Labour Party and vowed to set up their own party in opposition to Jeremy Corbyn. And finally, a high-profile trial involving voter fraud is taking place in North Carolina. But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. 16 states so far have sued the Trump administration for declaring a national emergency over the border wall. President Trump announced the emergency on Friday, saying, quote, "I could do the wall over a longer period of time. I don't need to do this, but I'd rather do it much faster," unquote. The lawsuit says that the president does not have the authority to divert funds for a border wall. British Prime Minister Theresa May is meeting European Commission Chief Jean-Claude Juncker on Wednesday in Brussels to talk about the Brexit deal, although the EU has said that no further negotiations are possible. The Brexit deadline is 5 weeks away on March 29th. Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn is also due to meet with the EU Brexit negotiator Michel Barnier later this week. U.S.-China trade talks are being held today in Washington. Higher-level talks will start later in the week and will be led by U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer. He'll be joined by Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, Economic Advisor Larry Kudlow, and Trade Advisor Peter Navarro. This week's talks follow negotiations in Beijing last week that officials say made substantial progress. Roger Stone was ordered to appear in court because of a photo he posted on social media that appeared to target the judge in his case with gun sights behind her. U.S. District Judge Amy Berman Jackson said Stone will need to prove how this behavior does not violate the gag order in his case. Stone has claimed the gun sights are a logo. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to politics. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders announced his candidacy for president this morning. Recent polls show Sanders narrowly trailing former Vice President Joe Biden for the Democratic nomination, but Sanders is expected to face fierce attacks from the Democratic Party establishment. We're joined from Atlanta by Anoa Changa. She's the director of political advocacy and a managing editor of Progressive Army, and she's the host of the show The Way with Anoa. Welcome back, Anoa.
Thanks for having me.
Anoa, it's not just fierce attacks from the Democratic Party. The general consensus is that Bernie Sanders may have a problem with women this time around because of some evidence of sexual harassment in his campaign, not perpetrated by him, but by senior campaign officials in 2016. And then just today on MSNBC, there was a segment saying that Bernie may also have problems with minorities. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Certainly. I mean, I know a lot of folks over the past couple of months, as these different allegations have come out, you know, talk about how these are things that are issues within the Democratic Party, within political campaigns. But I think, you know, as a movement space and as those, you know, for folks who are supporters of the senator and now his official launch, you know, his bid for president, these are things that actually need to definitely be addressed when you're positioning yourself as like the most progressive, as the revolutionary, as the person that's bringing about change like we haven't seen it before, right? And so the concerns, and I had someone ask me the other day, actually, was I satisfied with how he handled things? I actually don't really know what has come out of there was an open letter that several staffers, you know, men and women from the staff, you know, talked about sexual harassment, sexual violence, and just a certain, you know, environment within the campaign. And again, while it's true that this is, you know, a part of, unfortunately, campaign life and politics in general, at the same time, when you're talking about building a revolutionary space, when you're talking about building a progressive, better alternative to the establishment status quo, these types of issues are disheartening to hear about happening in these spaces. I mean, there are members of, you know, African American outreach and other constituency outreach teams that have their own accounts, not of sexual, you know, assault or anything, but of issues of being, you know, disinvested as a team and not being able to do the job that they were brought on to do in terms of, you know, building out the support for the senator in various communities. So when we're concerned about whether or not, you know, people talk about, oh, he's the highest rated amongst black voters or this, whatever polls that people want to throw out there. Those polls also say everyone loves Joe Biden, right? Polls are tricky sometimes. And my concern, what I want to see, you know, that's great that he has launched and he's out there. We're going to have a very competitive primary. I'm excited about that part. But what I want to see is, has the critique and the criticism, the valid critique and criticism, some of it, you know, out there and not on point at all, has that actually been digested by the Bernie apparatus? Are we going to see more diversification in senior leadership, not just, you know, in terms of racial and gender diversity and possibly, you know, either sexual orientation, et cetera, which is definitely necessary because representation is important, but representation alone is not enough. We also need people who are truly committed to not simply this bold progressive platform that Bernie Sanders has, but actually expanding our electorate and getting out there and building across the country with voters everywhere who deserve to be heard and brought into the system of electoral politics.
And Noah, in 2016, Bernie Sanders spent a lot of time talking about poverty. And that's something that most of the other Democrats weren't talking about. Should we expect anything different from him this time? And if not, if he continues to talk about poverty, do you think there's going to be any traction within the Democrats or among the Democrats?
Well, I think that Senator Sanders and what we saw in 2015 and 2016 definitely did help usher in a conversation that we're having nationally around the economic struggle of those, you know, that are at, you know, the bottom rungs of society, for lack of a better framing, at the moment. I do believe that he is consistent, you know, across his whole career. He's talked about certain issues. Part of my concern is making sure his conversation about those issues is actually accessible to the voters that a political insurgent campaign needs to reach in order to, you know, basically usurp power from the Democratic status quo, right, from the Democratic establishment. And at times, while it is a great conversation for all of us who are policy wonks and political analysis, it's great stuff, is it accessible, is it understandable to the person on the block, to the person in the holler who really needs to hear this? And in some instances, it has been. We need to see more of that. I do think that we have already seen some members who have announced, you know, kind of also trending in a more populist, progressive sort of way. But you have folks like Senator Amy Klobuchar, who's just like, nah, I'm not even going to entertain free college. I appreciate her for her honesty, but there is definitely going to be a split, I think, in this Democratic race with some, you know, folks going more progressive and really reading the room and the momentum of organizing spaces that have been working for the past several years, as well as those who are going to stick to what they know and think they can split the middle.
With all these Democrats running for president, so far there are officially, formally announced there are 10, as many as 25 considering the race. What is it that is going to set people apart? If everybody has, in general, a similar voting record, except maybe for Tulsi Gabbard, she has a lot of questions to answer about her position on social issues in the past, but she's the only truly anti-war candidate, I think, so far. But what issues do you think are out there that are going to set these two dozen or so people apart from each other?
I'm actually probably one of the few people who doesn't actually truly think she's an actual anti-war candidate. I know she's anti-intervention in particular instances, which has been really bold and different from what we're seeing from a lot of folks. I just throw that out there. But what we're going to see is we are going to have a lot of people saying things that sound very similar. When Kamala Harris in an article, when they were talking about, I think, five issue points or whatever, two of them, you know, and then describing what her point was, cited, you know, legislation that she co-sponsored that was Bernie Sanders' baby, basically, right? Medicare for All, and I think the other one might have been the college bill. So it's going to be really interesting watching this all unfold, because you are going to have folks who have decided to take some of the messaging and the work and make it their own, but they still have to reference back to Bernie. Whether or not Bernie Sanders can actually build the momentum, everyone talks about he has the largest fan base, you know, Facebook pages, all this stuff. That's a part of organizing. That is not in and of itself organizing to win and building what needs to be built to be able to claim the nomination and beyond, right? That's a part of it. And so we're seeing other candidates work with local groups. I mean, I don't know what Cory Booker's messaging is besides he got a PhD from the hood and some other jumbo stuff. But
right.
We are seeing everyone try to find their unique brand in this moment. But I think not just because Bernie said in the 2015, 2016, I always say this, I give a lot of credit to the grassroots and to organizers and organizations that have been doing this work going back. I mean, we have seen an uptick in leftist activism post 9/11, whether we're talking about, you know, the rise in the anti-war movement, you know, during the Iraq invasion and Afghanistan, whether we're talking about Occupy, Black Lives Matter, and the focus on electoral justice and movement for Black lives. I mean, we've had an uptick in activism and organizing around immigration issues. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's been happening, and Bernie Sanders ran at a good time to be able to capitalize, for lack of a better term, on a lot of that. And now we're seeing a moment now where people are like, wait a minute, we have these issues that need to not only be addressed, but you need to come and talk to our communities and explain why we need to vote. Yes, Donald Trump is awful, but you cannot disregard us like what we saw happening, unfortunately, in general elections in 2016. And I think what's going to separate folks from each other is how well people are able to get out there into communities across the country and be consistent in their messaging while unwavering to their commitment to justice across the board.
Tell me something. Are we doomed? I shouldn't even say we, because I'm not a Democrat. Are the Democrats doomed to just repeat what they do every 4 years by nominating the best known neoliberal pro-war nominee that differs very little when push comes to shove with the Republican nominee? Or is this the year of the insurgent? After the way Sanders was robbed in 2016, there was a little bit of tinkering around the edges of the rules surrounding the internal DNC rules surrounding the selection of delegates. So are we going to see an insurgent this year, or is this going to be business as usual for the Democrats?
The past 2 years have not been entirely business as usual, because the people from the various spaces around us electorally have mandated that it not be, right? We have seen more and more progressive, you know, led organizations directly challenging even Democrats on votes that are a particular concern. What I think we will see is that people need to understand they have to build their own machine. The Democratic establishment is a formidable machine. It is not going to go lightly. It's like Skynet, right? It's not going to go away just because, you know, you say it's a better thing for it to not exist. What needs to happen is a real deep organizing and building. One of the excuses last time when people wanted to defend Bernie Sanders is the fact that he didn't have enough time to build, which I disagree with, and I don't believe is actually true, or he didn't really realize he was going to win. But if you're only running, and this goes for everyone, if you're only running and you're only investing in building because you think you might win, then you're doing it all wrong.
That's right. That's the wrong reason to run for president. We're going to have to leave it there, Anoa. That was Anoa Changa. She joined us from Atlanta. Anoa is the director of political advocacy, and she's the managing editor of Progressive Army. She's also the host of the show, The Way with Anoa. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. President Trump issued a direct threat against Venezuela in a speech in Miami yesterday, urging the largely loyal Venezuelan military to move to the side of Juan Guaido. He said that those backing the elected government of Nicolas Maduro were risking their own lives, and that while the U.S. seeks a peaceful transition of power from Maduro to Guaido, quote, all options are open, unquote. We're joined from Mérida, Venezuela by Paul Dobson, a writer for VenezuelaAnalysis.com, and we're joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Welcome to both of you.
Happy to be here.
Great to be here.
Paul, let's start with you. President Maduro reacted quickly to this speech in Miami, saying that it was Nazi-like in its tone and that the humanitarian aid that President Trump is promising the Venezuelan people is fake. Tell us what people are saying in Venezuela about this latest development.
Well, there's not been much reaction here in Venezuela about the Trump speech as such, but there is, of course, a lot of build-up about the issue of the humanitarian aid, which is due to at least come to its first climax this Saturday, 23rd, which is a date which Juan Guaido had initially promised that he was going to make the aid enter the country, be what may. So we're now seeing a series of actions taken by both his camp and the pro-government camp in the build-up to Saturday, and there's a lot of talk on the streets about this aid. What does it consist of, what impact would it have if it actually comes into the country, and what are the potential consequences or actions that may develop in the border region on Saturday when he tries to force his aid into the country against the order which the military are fulfilling, which is to block it.
Walter, Miami has a lot of expatriate Venezuelans, and the conventional wisdom is that that's why the president elected to give this speech in Miami. Does that really matter when it comes to Venezuela policy?
I think that the speech in Miami served two basic purposes. One was, you know, like we've been talking about, sort of amping up the pressure on Venezuela and its government in the run-up to this February 23rd, you know, showdown that the opposition in the U.S. has manufactured. I mean, it's a completely manufactured, contrived political stunt. But I agree that it also had important domestic political implications. It was partially a campaign rally, right? I mean, Florida is a swing state. It has a lot of consequence in terms of national politics in the United States. And also, you know, I think that he set up sort of a campaign theme that he's going to be returning to, or at least, you know, is testing out to sort of make a major theme of in the 2020 presidential campaign. And that's opposing socialism, an ideological campaign against socialism. I mean, he sort of repeated his line from the State of the Union, you know, the United States will never become a socialist country. And so I think that it's taking on, you know, a more deeply ideological dimension than it has in the past. Paul, I mean, I'm interested in your take on that. I mean, President Trump says that, you know, socialism is the cause of all the woes and problems in Venezuela. It shows that it's a failed system. I mean, you're in Venezuela. You understand the economic crisis because, you know, you're there, right? You experience it every day. What do you think the causes are? I mean, what's your response to Trump's sort of ideological justification for this campaign of aggression?
Well, it's very clear how this sort of terminology benefits Trump in terms of the domestic policy making in the United States. But for anyone with half a brain, and I include all of us in that, it's very clear to see that there is no socialism at the moment in Venezuela. The government may declare that they're pushing towards socialism, and that is their objective. That's their long-term goal. But the current state of affairs is that we're as close to socialism here as you are in the United States to some extent. So the fact that Mr. Trump pushed Venezuela into this bracket to extract domestic campaign benefit from it is a mistake in itself. Anyone who comes to Venezuela and sees how the forces of capital, essentially the middle range bourgeoisie, the small producers and the shop owners do basically as they wish. They increase prices on a daily basis as they wish. There are no controls. The state-run industries are incredibly run down. And essentially, any sort of effort which has promoted the placing of the means of production in the hands of the people of Venezuela, it has been so badly administered or infiltrated by vices like corruption that it really doesn't lead the way in any sort of economic recovery, unfortunately, at the moment here in Venezuela. So as such, I think the terminology used by Trump, we should also point out that he talked about opening a way for restoring democracy in Cuba and Nicaragua as well, which clearly sets his path out of using Venezuela to basically infiltrate the Cuban and Nicaraguan sovereign processes as well. This is very much terminology which he uses to convince the American voters, but it's not based in any sort of day-to-day reality of what is going on the ground here.
I hear you, Paul. You know, there is, you know, a very serious situation in Venezuela today, but, you know, of course, we have to think about, you know, the conditions under which the government and for the past, you know, 20 years or since 2005, when, you know, Hugo Chavez announced the socialist character of the Bolivarian Revolution, the tremendous odds that they've had to face. I mean, you know, there's the sanctions, of course, that you and I and, you know, John and Brian have talked about on this show a lot before. But, you know, there's also the legacy of colonial underdevelopment in Venezuela, where, you know, since the military dictatorship in the early 20th century of Juan Vicente Gomez, you know, there's been sort of this dependency cultivated by, you know, the United States and different corporations based in Western Europe on, you know, one single commodity for export, and that's oil. And so when the price of oil goes down on the international market like it did, you know, a few years ago, that can be a very devastating hit and can sort of, you know, stall a lot of these really exciting projects that have been constructed over the course of the Bolivarian Revolution that sort of lay the foundations for a different type of society. Let's move on to this showdown that's looming on February 23rd. The Cuban government has said that they've detected the movement of U.S. troops in the region. The United States has been openly using military aircraft to transport this humanitarian aid to Colombia, which is governed by a president who, is widely accused of having links to the paramilitary death squads that are so influential in that country. Where do you think it's all heading?
Well, let's hope it doesn't lead to any sort of explosion or confrontation on the border. Just when you were talking about the economic crisis, I mean, the economic crisis in Venezuela, the causes, I think, are a cocktail of a number of different factors. And we have to range in their corruption, bad administration, sanctions, a whole range of factors. But what I am completely convinced of is that the solution to the economic problem is not 10 days worth of lentils, which is what the humanitarian aid essentially is made up of. 10 days worth of rice, flour, lentils, and vegetable oil. I don't think any economic problems in Venezuela will be solved by this. The economic problems in Venezuela, the first step, I think, in my opinion, has to be solved by increasing domestic production and potentially readdressing the exchange rate disparities. But they're not going to be solved by an aid package from USAID. This is very clear to everyone here on the ground. So this Saturday, what we're seeing is essentially a political circus being set up. The way things are looking at the moment is that we are going to have on Saturday two counter concerts organized, one by Juan Guaido just across the border in the Colombian side, and one just on the Venezuelan side organized by the government. We're going to see a lot of people from both sides of the camp on the streets on the border. I would expect the border itself will be closed or very highly watched over by the military. And Juan Guaido is going to try to force this aid into the country. We're not quite sure yet how he plans to do this. But what we have noticed in the last 48 hours is a slight stepping down of his position, a weakening of his position. Juan Guaido, due to certain political inexperiences, I would say, issued many ultimatums to the government. Now, for a politician to issue an ultimatum, he must be very sure that he is going to be able to follow through with this ultimatum. And these ultimatums have all been ignored by the government, making Guaido look very foolish. So he has warned the government that on the 23rd, the aid will come in no matter what. Now, yesterday, Guaido came out with a slightly different line. He said, the aid is going to come in no matter what. If it's not the 23rd, then it might be the 24th. So this marks a very important backing down from him in this position.
Paul, we have a minute and a half left, and I'm curious about your situation. Are you having trouble finding food? Do you have trouble with your electricity? Or what's your daily life like?
No, in terms of the food, you can find nearly everything, unless you're looking for anything particularly luxurious, caviar or French cheese, let's say. But all of the basic foodstuffs you can find in nearly every supermarket. The problem is often the prices. The prices are exorbitant and out of range for most people on a minimum wage in Venezuela. Power cuts are regular. In other parts of the country, they are a lot worse, without a doubt. Cuts in the water supply, again, are increasingly regular. Generally, the public services are quite deteriorated. But in terms of the shortages, both of food and to some extent medicines, especially basic medicines, the situation is much better than it was many years ago and is entirely exaggerated by some of the mainstream press, I would say.
Yeah, you know, I just one sort of bizarre thing I wanted to get your take on in just our last 30 seconds here. Richard Branson, the British billionaire,
yeah,
is financing.
What's up with that?
Yeah, financing like a concert/opposition demonstration. I mean, what's going on?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if Richard Branson should Juan Guaido succeed in knocking over Nicolas Maduro. Maybe we'll see some nice, juicy telecommunication contracts for Richard Branson in Venezuela. Who knows what's being discussed behind closed doors?
I think that has the potential for violence. It has the potential to further divide the country, and it's something I think neither side should be doing. Anyway, we'll leave it there. We were joined from Mérida, Venezuela, by Paul Dobson, a writer for VenezuelaAnalysis.com, and we were joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik news analyst and one of the producers of this show. So stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Facebook has blocked the viral video channel In the Now after CNN accused it of being a Kremlin propaganda outlet aimed at American millennials and of hiding its leadership structure. But it never did any such thing. We're joined from Pittsburgh, America's most livable city, by Jim Cavanaugh, the editor of thepolemicist.net, whose most recent article is The Siege of Venezuela and the Travails of Empire. Welcome back, Jim.
Thanks for having me.
Jim, I Googled In the Now just to make sure I had my recollections correct. BuzzFeed did an article in 2016 about In the Now, saying that it was owned and operated by RT. No secret there. And then in 2017, an article appeared on a European website saying, oh, this thing In the Now, it's becoming more and more popular. It's owned by RT. Day before yesterday, CNN came out and said, oh my God, this thing is owned by RT. So why all the excitement all of a sudden, leading to Facebook suspending it?
You know, it's as you say, John, it's this situation where they discovered there was water in the Pacific Ocean.
I mean, the sky is blue. The sky is blue. Breaking news.
There's no secret here. Nobody was hiding anything. It had been reported before, but this breathless reporting of it by a guy, or I think it was a former FBI agent who, you know, through his super sleuthing abilities, figured out that public records showed and had shown for many years who the ownership of this In the Now was. I didn't know who was behind In the Now, and I didn't care. But it was available to everybody who knew it, and it was published in other journals. So what's the deal?
Yeah, you know, I watched videos on In the Now. I actually did not know that it was owned by RT. I don't care. I'd get a chuckle out of it. You know, like anybody else, I'm a sucker for clickbait videos. It wasn't political. I don't recall it ever being political in any way. So who cares if it's owned by RT?
Well, no. I think what the reason they're going after it is because Rania Kallik is very good. She's done, and this happened after her video on Venezuela, and she's got punchy political videos. She's very smart. She presents this stuff in a way that's accessible and powerful, and she has an effect. And that's why they're going after it, because it is something that people are listening to and seeing, and it might have an effect on people's minds. The only people on RT were a bunch of clowns. They wouldn't care about it as much.
Jim Cavanaugh is our guest. Jim is the editor of thepolemicist.net. His most recent article is The Siege of Venezuela and the Travails of Empire. I think you're right, Jim. I think this is another instance whereby alternative media that's not comporting to the dominant narrative that is being served up like an echo chamber in all of the corporate-owned media. They have Rania Kallik, who's an excellent journalist, who's very on point, who's got a big following, and she's telling the truth about Venezuela, just like other people on In the Now were telling the truth about Syria. And as a consequence, Facebook, which we know is partnering with the Atlantic Council and other neocon organizations that are, again, funded in part by the U.S. government and by the military, in the case of Atlantic Council, by NATO, they're the ones going to tell people this is acceptable or not acceptable. And here, of course, because they don't want to be accused of purely shutting down dissent, they're hiding behind the idea or the suggestion that the problem is the ownership structure of In the Now was obscured. That's just not true. I mean, anybody who was actually paying careful attention, who knows the reporters, who knows this network, knows that it's RT.
Well, yeah, it's also the case that Facebook does not have a policy that you have to do that. It's YouTube does, but Facebook doesn't. And if they're going to have a policy that everybody has to put little stickers on showing who funds them, then go ahead and do that. But warn everybody about it in advance, give them a chance to set it up, and be fair and consistent about it. But this is not what they did. That was an excuse. It's clearly an excuse. They went after someone and that was left and that was giving a left dissident voice on important issues. Venezuela is an important issue, that things are happening right now, you know, in the next couple of days. And they did it because it was a dissident left voice that was effective. And that's what they went after for. And Facebook should be ashamed. This is one of the most egregious things I've seen. But this is what was going to be coming. You saw it coming from the day they did this with Alex Jones. You could see what was coming down the line.
Oh, it was coming. One of my colleagues, Nicole Roussel, pointed out just a few minutes ago that not only has the RT sponsorship of In the Now been public in articles in BuzzFeed and elsewhere before this stupid CNN article. But it actually says on the screen when you're watching the video that it's owned in whole or in part by the Russian government. So nobody, literally nobody, was trying to keep this a secret. Honestly, this CNN reporter, I think, ought to be fired for pretending that this is news. There's nothing newsworthy about this at all.
But this is what they're doing. To me, this whole scenario, it's so depressing to watch the party line unanimity with which they are treating things like Venezuela and things that are outrageous on the face of it, you know, and they just won't let anybody on who gives a dissenting point of view. They just won't let it. And it's crazy. And now they're trying to push people off who are doing perfectly normal and good work on social media. There's nothing wrong with what Ron Jakalik is doing, In the Now is doing, and they're just going to squash it. They're going to squash it. And they came out with the bait, with the lost leader, the little. They went after the clowns first. They went after Alex Jones, and now it's going to be, wait a minute, Ron Jakalik.
And, you know, the old saying, and when they came for me, there was no one left. I couldn't believe several months ago I found myself defending Alex Jones. And it's not that I was defending Alex Jones or anything that Alex Jones stands for, but Alex Jones has as much a right to go on Facebook or Twitter or YouTube or whatever as I do to talk about anything he wants. And sure enough, you know, here they are taking something off of Facebook just because it's associated with RT. Well, what about CGTN? What about Al Jazeera? What about even BBC? Where's the line going to be drawn, and who's responsible for drawing that line?
And the idea that this complicated way they're trying to gin up something that doesn't sound like what it is. They're trying to make it, it's because they're foreign funding, it's because of this, it's because that, because we don't like the political content of it. That's what it is. And Facebook, Twitter, social media have to decide whether they're curated political magazines or whether they're for people to come in and say what they want, say what they feel like. You know, there was nothing hateful or in any way, shape, or form with what Ron Jakalik was doing, and there was nothing nasty about it. It was political speech, and they're trying to make it into something else. Then we're going after political speech we don't like. That's what they're doing.
So do you think YouTube is going to follow? In the Now is still on YouTube. I checked it just a few minutes before we began recording this segment, and YouTube has not made a statement. But are we seeing a domino effect here?
Well, I think there's going to be a lot of pressure for them to do so. I think that, I don't know, and I hope that they don't. And, you know, they I think there are differential responses to this pressure that's coming down, but it's very hard. And what you're seeing is that these organizations have to deal with government pressure that's very difficult. And they I think, sympathize with it content-wise. We don't want to see this content either, but we got to find a way of justifying it that isn't so obviously we just don't like this political speech.
So in the 2 minutes we have left, is there any way that you can think of for people to demand access to content? I mean, Facebook is a publicly traded company. Is there any way that Facebook's users can put their foot down and say, we want to see this content, when they failed to make any inroads in that direction when things like, let's say, CopBlock were taken off the site, off the platform?
Unfortunately, I can't see a strong way to do that, because unless it hurts them in the pocketbook, and they see that this is it's a direct result of doing X that we lost Y amount of money, the pressure that's going to come from the government is going to be stronger than the pressure, and from these kind of quasi-governmental agencies, is going to be stronger than the pressure that comes from people who miss in the Now. That's the problem. I'm not sanguine about it at all.
I have to agree with you. You feel powerless because, you know, you wake up in the morning and two dozen sites that you've relied on for information are suddenly gone. And it's because this corporate giant decided that you don't get to see that news anymore. Like many Americans, I get most of my news, not most now, but much of my news from Twitter and Facebook, because a lot of my friends or associates will post things from outlets that I just don't have the time to canvas. I actually am less well informed now, thanks to Facebook and Twitter and YouTube stripping their sites of many of these outlets.
You know, and it wasn't like these things were easy to find anyway for the general public. You know, I'm out here in Western Pennsylvania. I see people sitting in their recliners watching either Fox all day or MSNBC all day. And, you know, they're getting the story. They're getting a story. And it's pretty much within a very tight Overton window of what's a government, you know, establishment approved, let's put it that way, and ideas. And so I can go online, I can do In the Now, I can go to Information Clearinghouse, I have my website, you know, a few hundred people or a few thousand people maybe look at, you know, and I'll go to, I'll listen to Sputnik Radio, and but, you know, I get ridiculed for being on Sputnik Radio, you know, and this is what happens. And so they keep it already, it's kept out of sight for the most part, and people are shamed and ridiculed for looking at it or participating in it. And now they're just going to cut it out.
Yeah. And I think we're going to see more of the same. We're going to have to leave it there, Jim. We were joined from Pittsburgh by Jim Kavanaugh, the editor of thepolemicist.net, whose most recent article is The Siege of Venezuela and the Travails of Empire. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou, in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. Seven members of the British Parliament left the Labour Party yesterday, criticizing Jeremy Corbyn's leadership and sending shockwaves through the country's political system. As Brexit and the possibility of a new election looms, this split could prove to be exactly what Conservative Prime Minister Theresa May needs to stay in power. We're joined from London by Neil Clark. He's a journalist and broadcaster whose work has appeared in The Guardian, The Week, and Morningstar. And we're joined here in the studio by Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. Welcome back, both of you.
Happy to be here.
Hi there.
Neil, let's start with you. This was a shock for many of us who watch British politics. I've watched British politics for 35 years, and I was shocked by this. Just when you thought things were going well for Jeremy Corbyn, he was a strong voice for Labour, seven MPs break off from the party, and now they're talking about having another party formed by the end of the year. Corbyn, of course, is beside himself. He's been blaming Theresa May, according to The Guardian, of trying to lure these seven MPs out of the Labour Party. What exactly are we looking at here for Labour?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, John, that we've had a lot of talk about this happening for a couple of years now, really. Certainly the last few months, every day it seems that the following week we're going to have a breakaway group leaving from Labour because they were so upset about the direction that the party was going in under Corbyn. And it was a bit like the boy who cried wolf. We were getting to the stage where we didn't actually think it would happen and that what these people would do would be to stay in Labour and sort of try to defeat Corbyn from within. The fact of the matter, John, is that the Labour Party, the background to this is the Labour Party under Corbyn, who became the leader in 2015, against all the odds, really. The party has moved away from the kind of what we'd call the Blairite, Tony Blairite positions that it held for the previous probably 20 years or so. Those positions were, the key ones were support for regime change wars around the globe, particularly in the Middle East. The Iraq War, of course, happened under Tony Blair. Support for neoliberal economics, privatization. It was a kind of, would you like, a Thatcherite-lite program, really. And Jeremy Corbyn, who was a democratic socialist, comes from a very different tradition in the party. The party that part of the party that really under Blair didn't really have much of a voice. He opposed all those wars. He opposed the war in Iraq. He opposed the war against Afghanistan. He opposed the bombing of Libya in 2011. And also he wanted to have a move to a more socialistic economic model with renationalization of things that have been privatized. And I think quite crucially, I've got to mention this, Jeremy Corbyn has been a lifelong supporter of the Palestinian cause. And Blairism was very much strongly pro-Israel. So you don't have to be a rocket scientist, Albert Einstein, to work out why the sort of hardcore Blairites were pretty horror-struck when this guy, Jeremy Corbyn, who they thought was just a guy who was going to spend all his life on the back benches, became party leader. They saw it as the left taking control of the party. And they've been threatening this breakaway for a long time. And it finally happened yesterday with seven leaving, as you said. The question is now, really, is what impact will it have on Labour's electoral chances? Will it actually reduce the chances of a Corbyn-led government or actually increase the chances?
We've seen this before, haven't we? When David Owen broke off from Labour and formed the Social Democratic Party in the 1980s, it took Labour a little while to regain its footing in those late Thatcher years. Is that what you expect to see this time around?
No, and I'll tell you why. I wrote a piece for Sputnik, the website. Listeners can see it on the website about, it was actually entitled, It's Not 1981, Why Labour Should Not Fear a Centrist, inverted commas, Breakaway. I wrote that back in August last year when, again, there was talk about a breakaway. I'll tell you why it's different, John, to 1981. In 1981, there was, as you said, there was the breakaway group. They called themselves the Gang of Four. They were called that by the media. Four former Labour ministers had the press conference, and they left the Labour Party, and they formed the Social Democratic Party in 1981. And they had incredible success. As you said, quite rightly, they did great damage to the Labour Party's electoral cause, so much so that we went 18 years from 1979 to 1997 before we had a Labour government. And the SDP took a large share of the anti-conservative vote in the 80s. And that was enough, really, to give Margaret Thatcher 11 years in Downing Street. But why were they so successful? It's because where we were politically. After the 1979 election defeat, Labour did move to the left and was talking about, you know, major nationalisation. They wanted to leave the European Union, or the EEC as it was called then. And there was also the policy of unilateral nuclear disarmament during the time of the old Cold War. The Conservatives, meanwhile, under Mrs. Thatcher, had moved to the, what do you call, the radical right. They were privatising. They were following Reaganomics, early Reaganomics, before Reagan actually came first here in Britain. And they were privatizing. And so basically the key point is that the post-war economic consensus, the post-war model, we talked about it from 1945 to 79, was threatened by both Labour and Conservatives. Labour was moving away from it to the left because they took that defeat, and the left was saying, look, we wanted more socialism. That's why we didn't win in 79. The Conservatives were moving rapidly to the right. So there was a real genuine market gap for a genuine centre party in 1981 that basically wanted to preserve the quite popular post-war economic model that provided full employment for most people, full employment for most of the time, a mixed economy. And Roy Jenkins, who was the kind of intellectual guru behind the Social Democratic Party, he had heft. He had a genuine political philosophy, which was popular. And that was evidenced, John, by the polls. The opinion polls showed that straight away they were getting in the high 20s, and they actually peaked. They actually got, at one point, there was a poll showing they had 52%, I think it was, of support among the public within 1 year or less than that of being formed. So I think it's wholly the analogy. I don't think you can make an analogy with what happened then in the 80s with the SDP, who were generally popular. They had politicians with very strong CVs, cabinet ministers who had a personal following, and they were putting policies that were generally popular with a large chunk of the electorate. I don't think you can compare that with now, because these characters today, I call them the not so magnificent seven. They don't have any of that. What are they putting forward, John? They're putting forward actually pretty unpopular policies. If they've actually got any policies that they put forward, it's basically reheated Blairism, which really has fallen out of favour in Britain. Blairism is so old news. It's so yesterday's. People have said these people are trapped in a 1997 time warp. You know, what are they offering except more of the same status quo, failed status quo policies? They're pro-war. Nearly all these MPs that left have all supported these wars that are hugely unpopular now. They really haven't got the popularity, I don't think. And I think they would all struggle, John, to win at a by-election or at a general election. I think they'd all lose their seats. I think this is more about wrecking Corbyn and trying to damage his chances. I don't think there's genuine public support for a party putting forward Blairism in 2019 in Britain.
You know, that's really the question, Walter, isn't it? Does the country need another party, another left-wing party?
Well, I mean, I think the political party that these seven will form, or, you know, or have intended to form, is basically, I mean, that lane is kind of already filled in British politics. I mean, wouldn't you agree, Neil? I mean, there's the Liberal Democratic Party.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, it's nothing new. It's nothing new.
And they did terribly in the last election, didn't they? They lost a lot of seats, and they're getting in single, very much in single figure polling.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, Neil, we have just a little over 2 minutes left. I just wanted to get to this allegation of, quote unquote, rampant anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. I mean, when these seven members of parliament left, they cited that as one of the main reasons, maybe the main reason, that they decided to break away. Now, one of the seven, Angela Smith, went on TV and referred to people of color as people, quote, with a funny tinge, which kind of undercut her anti-racist credentials, to say the least. But what do you make of this whole, the anti-Semitism controversy within the Labour Party?
Well, I'm actually just writing an article on this, and I think it's fascinating. I've called it the kind of 2019 equivalent of the Iraqi WMD's claims from 2003, because it's a similar sort of thing. It's repeated ad nauseum by a lot of mainstream commentators and politicians that Labour has a huge anti-Semitism problem, rather like we were told Iraq has WMDs. But actually, if you look at the evidence, as in 2003, it's not there. The figures are very interesting. The release by Jenny Formby, the Labour Party General Secretary last week, shows that there were 600 complaints made against Labour Party members, and over 200 of those have failed to reach the basic criteria, evidential criteria, to actually have an investigation. And out of all the cases that have so far been looked at, it's resulted in just 12 expulsions of members. This is a party, don't forget, that we have, which has about 500,000 members. So we're talking about a very, very 0.08%, I think it is, very, very tiny percentage of Labour members who have been found to have tweeted or posted material that was deemed to be anti-Semitic. We've got to get it in those terms, in that perspective. So to say the Labour Party, like yesterday, the Seven, made that in the statement about institutionally anti-Semitic, it's nonsense, because the Labour Party had a Jewish leader. The previous leader was Jewish. There are Jewish people prominent in groups like Momentum in the Labour Party. The co-founders are Jewish. So it doesn't stack up in the same way the Iraqi WMDs claimed it didn't stack up. This is, I think, is a smear. It's about trying to use this to try to stop Corbyn, or to try to get Corbyn to lose popularity, to have this narrative that somehow it's a racist party. You know, it isn't. And I think, as I said, just look at the figures. They don't back it up.
We'll have to leave it there. We were very pleased to be joined from London by Neil Clark. Neil's a journalist and a broadcaster whose work has appeared in The Guardian, The Week, and Morning Star. And we were joined in the studio by Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou, in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. Investigators in North Carolina have determined that a political operative working on behalf of a Republican congressional candidate oversaw an illegal absentee ballot scheme and went to elaborate lengths to conceal it. The finding could lead to a new election for what is the only still undecided congressional race in the country. We're joined from Philadelphia by Dave Lindorf. He's an investigative reporter and founder of This Can't Be Happening, as well as a columnist for Counterpunch and a contributor to the London Review of Books, The Nation, Extra, Tarbell, and Salon.com. Welcome back, Dave.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Dave, we're in the middle of February, and this one congressional race has not been decided yet. It's also ironic to me that the Republicans are always jumping up and down about voter fraud, and here is the only proven voter fraud in America, and it was the Republicans that perpetrated it.
You know, I'm not really surprised by that. You know, the whole thing has been that the Republican Party is a party with a declining voter base. You know, it's the white male and, to a lesser extent, white female voter base, and that is a declining part of the American population, quite significantly so. Some states, the white population is now the largest minority. And so the Republicans, all the way back to Karl Rove and other strategists, have been figuring out ways to stretch out their control of the country through reducing the non-white vote. So there's voter suppression all over the place. And the one we are seeing in North Carolina, the one where you trick people into thinking that they're filing absentee ballots or mail-in ballots, and then you throw them away or you don't get them counted. And that was a huge issue for several elections in Ohio when the whole apparatus of the voting security and everything under the Secretary of State was all in the hands of Republicans. And that's where we see it happening, Republican states with voter suppression efforts.
Explain to us, too, what the different scenarios are here. I've read in the New York Times, the Washington Post, et cetera, that the state's electoral commission can either vacate the results of the race and have a new election. They can refuse to seat the Republican who at this point claims he won. But there seems to be evidence also that the Republican who ran in the general may have cheated in the primary to defeat an incumbent Republican congressman. So what happened in that case?
I don't actually know what the methodology of the cheating was, but it stands to reason that, you know, once you develop these mechanisms to cheat, then they can be applied anywhere in any election. So, you know, if Republicans are developing these techniques for, you know, cheating the voter, then they can do it in a primary just as easily. I mean, the Democrats we saw methods of screwing with the elections during the Hillary Sanders race. And those were techniques that have been applied by Republicans that Democrats were using against each other. It was an internecine method. And it's usually the horrific candidates, the worst candidates that are using those techniques because they're not going to be able to get the votes.
You know, let's talk exactly about what the Republicans are being accused of doing here. They're being accused of forging signatures. They're being accused of completing ballots for people and then mailing them from post offices near the voter's home. They may have been involved in more than 1,000 absentee ballots or voter request forms. And in some cases, they went to people's houses, asked them to sign blank ballots, told them, "We'll take care of it for you," voted for the Republican on behalf of the voter, and then went to the post office and mailed the absentee ballot in. There are like 5 different felonies just in that short scenario. So in the end, This state board is comprised of 3 Democrats and 2 Republicans. It has the power to determine whether the results of the election should be certified or whether they should call a new election. We're in February now. Why haven't they called a new election? Why haven't they taken any concrete steps yet?
You know, I haven't got an answer for that. It seems so patently obvious. Like, I know they wanted to take the testimony because they don't want to be, you know, I imagine that the Democratic majority on the panel doesn't want to be accused of stealing an election. So they want to have the evidence. So that's probably why. Why it took so long to get to the hearings, I don't know. But, you know, it seems like if you have an election and you have clear evidence that if the count shows that one candidate won by 900 and then you find out that same candidate's party and activists stole or got rid of or falsified thousands of votes, that the election is already decided. Right? Why run it again? But, you know, who knows?
I want to read you something from the New York Times. There's a woman involved in this case by the name of Lisa Britt. She has been called as a witness. At first, she refused to testify. Actually, what she said, and this is according to the transcript, "I'm taking the Fifth Amendment because I don't have an attorney and I feel like you're trying to trip me up. I'm just taking the Fifth." She didn't take the Fifth. She went on to answer questions and repeatedly implicated herself in multiple felonies. She's already a convicted felon and she voted illegally. Now, there was a woman who voted illegally in Texas that was sentenced to something like 5 years or 7 years in prison. I don't know what Ms. Britt is going to get if she's prosecuted for voting illegally. But she says that she had personally collected between 35 and 40 absentee ballots in violation of the law and that she altered, her words, between 5 and 10 of them. But she says her 5 or 10 didn't have any effect on the race. She says here, "We didn't mail more than 9 or 10 at a time because we didn't want to throw up a red flag." So it seems like what she's saying is we knew what we were doing was illegal. We did it anyway. And yes, it actually did affect the race. Am I reading too much into that?
No, I think that's absolutely right.
Well, it says here, by late November, the state officials were concerned about the possibility of fraud. The board refused to certify Mr. Harris as the winner and ordered the inquiry that Ms. Stratch said included 142 voter interviews, at least 30 interviews with subjects and witnesses, and a review of reams of documents. So that's all done, and they determined that there was indeed voter fraud. So then, the big question is, what happens after there's an election called? Because I really believe firmly that there's going to be another election called. Are we talking about prosecutions now? Are people going to be made examples of in North Carolina?
that's going to depend on the prosecutors in North Carolina if it unless it becomes a federal issue. I mean, it is a federal election, so, you know, you could have a Justice Department come in. You want to put any bets on whether a Republican Department of Justice will go after a Republican voter fraud? I don't know. They may say, well, we'll leave it to the state.
And I'm wondering, too, where the coverage is of Russian intervention in this congressional race. I haven't seen any of that.
Well, you know, I've said all along that, you know, to the extent that, you know, taking things at what they're charged, that, you know, that Russia tried to influence the election with some bots and fake news on Facebook and I guess Instagram, we're talking about tiny numbers and of ads and, you know, tiny numbers of people influenced. The real problem in the United States is that our election system really sucks, that Republicans are incredibly corrupt in trying to minimize the vote and, you know, suppress votes among blacks and Hispanics and old people and, you know, your typical Democratic voter. And, you know, and this is well documented. I mean, we know that they tried that, what the hell is the guy's name in that was the Secretary of State in Kobach in Kansas, who set up this whole scheme to run millions of people off of the voter rolls. And it was done in state after state, Republican states, states that went Republican, like Florida, Ohio, South Carolina, Georgia, I think Alabama. A lot of states used his method, and what it was to take these lists of convicted felons and send them around to Republican Secretary of States and say, you should purge your rolls of these people, they're convicted felons. But they were all names like Freeman and Jones and Smith and, you know, names, and especially with first names like Jamal and Jamal. And, you know, when you see a name like Jamal Smith, you know that's a black person, right? How many white people are named Jamal Smith? And Freeman is a very common name for freed slaves and their descendants. And so they go through these names, and yes, they're names of felons, but they're also names of like hundreds of other people. And so then these secretaries of states in these Republican states would just ban all of them. That goes all the way back to 2000, you know, in that contested election in Florida. They found that hundreds of thousands of people have been purged from the rolls illegally by calling them felons. And when you come in and they say, oh, you're not registered to vote, your voter registration was thrown out, your only recourse at that point is to file a provisional ballot, which never gets counted.
No, it never gets counted. That's voter suppression. We'll leave it there. We were joined from Philadelphia by Dave Lindorf, an investigative reporter and founder of This Can't Be Happening, as well as a columnist for Counterpunch and a contributor to the London Review of Books, The Nation, Extra, Tarbell, and Salon.com. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.